The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from The Awakening of Faith. All bodhisattvas aspire to the enlightenment realized by the Buddhas and ancestors, disciplining themselves to this end and steadily advancing towards it. Briefly, three types of aspiration for enlightenment can be distinguished. The first is the aspiration for enlightenment through the perfection of faith. The second is the aspiration through understanding and through deeds. The third is the aspiration for enlightenment through insight. I mentioned the other day that this is a text that was very influential in Mahayana Buddhism, in Japan, in China, Korea. Throughout East Asian Buddhism, and was written around the 6th century. And it takes up one of the main issues it takes up is the Tathagatagarbha, the womb of the Buddha, which can be understood as Buddha nature, which is sometimes referred to as the potential for enlightenment, which is not quite, I mean, there's potential in the sense of a practice and realization. But the Buddha nature that is within each one of us and within all things is not in an incipient form. It's fully present, completely manifested. It's complete from the beginning. And the other day I talked about faith, this first aspiration for enlightenment through the perfection of faith, and the wondrous quality of faith as being something that seems so uniquely human, that we can trust something before we've experienced it. We can, in a sense, know something, have a sense of knowing that something is true before we've actually verified that. I think many of us in encountering the Dharma for the first time had that sense. When I first encountered it, I had the sense more than I knew. In a sense, the experience I had was beyond my ability at that moment to even understand what I was experiencing, but that it was, I later came to realize, was basically having made contact with something that on some level I already knew was true. But in a sense, I had no basis for knowing that. I didn't know anything about Buddhism. I hadn't practiced it. I hadn't even read about it. I was just encountering it. And yet, that very strong and tangible inner experience that hopefully leads us on. Here, or throughout all of these, each of these three aspirations is the notion of aspiration itself, which is another wondrous workings of the mind, that we can aspire for something, that we can give rise to a thought, citta, and that aspiration can be something that might be of our world, like, so we can aspire to go to school or to do some sort of training or to undertake some sort of activity. And we see lots of examples around us, and we see if, you know, you do this and you do this and you do this, this will come. And in a way, that's a kind of aspiration. But aspiration within the Buddha Dharma is different, same and different. Because it really is, to a certain degree, not based on anything that we've yet experienced. It's not based on anything that we actually know. Although we may have had glimpses of possibilities. And the... Oops. The... thank you. And the tension within aspiration, because we are aspiring for enlightenment, and even if we've never read about what that means in Buddhism, that word is very potent, very pregnant with meaning in the West. And so even before Buddhism, we already have an idea. We already know in some level, even if we're not really conscious or not articulating, what enlightenment is. And so the challenge, and then particularly when we begin studying the Dharma, is how do we have that aspiration without forming anything fixed in our mind? How do we have aspiration without it being an expectation? Having an aspiration that's not based in grasping. In a sense, that's not based in all of the sort of unskillful habits that we've already developed, that we turn to all the time whenever we're doing something. And so, of course, we will turn to those. And that becomes part of, as practitioners, what we are learning, developing, is how do we actually have aspiration in a way that's truly aspiration and truly helping us, serving us, and which really means that it's in accord with the Dharma itself. And kind of like faith, it's sort of like aspiration is kind of like a communication from within. You know, Dogen speaks about this inner chamber, entering the inner chamber of the Buddhas. And it's sort of like these moments where, like in a pond where a bubble, everything's calm, nothing's happening, and suddenly a bubble. Boop. And you realize there's something going on down there. Right? You can't see it. The surface looks calm, but something's going on down there that suddenly... Boop. And it's as though these messages, these communications from deep within that arise as faith, that arise as a sense of confidence or knowing something that we don't actually know yet, this aspiration. And so the second form of aspiration in this passage from the Awakening of Faith is aspiration for enlightenment through understanding and actions. And it says, in this form of aspiration, the practitioner, the bodhisattva, comes to have a profound understanding of the principle of suchness and to have no attachment to their attainments obtained through their discipline. Now, discipline in Buddhism very often, if not usually, refers to morality, to the precepts. And we can see why that would be translated that way, that in terms of living a life of non-harming, living a life in accord with what is not harmful and what is beneficial, because we have so many habits and grasping and attachments and desires and so on, and so many examples of actions that can be harmful. And that those habits are very strong, so we have to develop some inner discipline. And, you know, I was thinking during the session that, you know, with words like discipline, Gokhan gave a talk on effort and talked about how, you know, people can have different relationships with that, you know, that can be tainted with, you know, a kind of aggressiveness or a kind of punishing quality. And I was thinking about that later, and I thought, you know, we need to reclaim those words rather than just not use them and sort of lose the sense of what we do need. Also, I was thinking of should, you know, that word should, that often, you know, in talks, you know, the speaker will sort of qualify, like, you know, we shouldn't be functioning by shoulds, which is true because of the punishing nature in which that word is so often used. But damn it, sometimes I should do something, right? Sometimes should is appropriate. And so can we reclaim those words and their meaning and use them as they should be used for our purpose, right? For our benefit. And then spread that around a little bit. And so the author talks about entertaining no attachment to attainments. And so in the Tibetan tradition, there's a teacher who talked about this and said, you should never become too confident in your realization. As you see, and we can really understand this at all different points along the way. Because from the very beginning, we start having experiences. From the very first moment that you start sitting, you begin having experiences that are connected to your practice, that are connected to your zazen, because that's what we do. We're always having experiences, sensations, right? Results of something that we do. And so from the very beginning all the way through, he's saying, don't be too confident in your realization. As he says, as you experience the nature of mind to be empty. But again, we can apply this liberally to any confidence that is not skillful. And so he says the important thing really is how you relate to those experiences. More than the experience itself. It is more important for meditators that are unskilled in dealing with experience to look carefully at how they are relating to them rather than worrying about the experiences themselves. Why is that so? The experience is already there. It's in you. And to that degree, it has changed you. It is in your consciousness at all levels. It has already, in a sense, informed to a certain degree. When we grab onto it, right, it's sort of like, you know, we're storytellers. We love stories. And so when something is happening out here, right, which is where the story seems to be, that's what we get infatuated with. And what really is happening in practice so much of the time is we need to look not at the story so much, but at how we're relating to it, because that's where we're creating karma. That's where we're either bound or we're free. That's where our patterns are. He says, we may divert our attention from the empirical world, the world of reality, of what's right in front of you, if we exaggerate the importance of realization of reality. In this way, you may no longer be feeling that you belong to the world, and you disregard your moral responsibilities towards others. In other words, you can develop the extreme view of nihilism, which is essentially about concluding that everything's emptiness and therefore nothing matters, which is not emptiness at all. It has nothing to do with emptiness. That happens in our mind. That's just another mental construction. And grossly misunderstanding the nature of emptiness. He says, if we fail to gain understanding based in this true nature of things, we will only develop a vague sense of the equity or the equality or the non-differentiation of things, but we'll have no enthusiasm for engaging in life or helping our fellow human beings. We'll enter into a state of total introversion or self-absorption where we're oblivious to things going on around us. He says this: the consequence of this is complete ignorance of skillful means. In other words, something that is really of the nature to bring us into our lives, into the world of others, and to make us more effective as human beings, more of service, actually has the opposite effect. And so this bodhisattva here, in this aspiration for enlightenment, has an understanding of the principle of suchness. And before that's our experience, that means our understanding as the Dharma teaches the nature of suchness, which is the reality of each moment, which is what's happening right now. And then to be very diligent about not clinging to our attainments, our experiences. Prajnaparamita is the mother of all Buddhas. Prajnaparamita is the realization of suchness. Prajna is the understanding that transcends, goes beyond our ordinary understanding, and yet is fully in harmony with our ordinary understanding. It frees us from delusion. and suffering, and yet is perfectly in harmony with suffering and delusion. It's like the radiance of the sun. The sun shines in all directions. You know, we think of it as our sun. It's our sun, right? Because it shines on the earth. Well, actually, it shines on the earth because we're in the sun's path, right? The sun actually shines everywhere. It's the universe's sun. It shines in every direction, and it shines equally, right? We don't get the best side, right? It shines in every direction, even the sides of the sun that we've never seen. It shines equally. And yet here on earth, some objects may be somewhat hidden, right, from the sun's radiance. And so it might be not as bright or as warm. But it's not because the sun isn't shining equally everywhere. So something seemed to be in shadow, but the light is still there. Even when the sky is covered in clouds, the sun is still shining. That's why that's such an excellent metaphor, because we can understand that. We know that the sun is still there. That's the nature of the womb of the Buddha, the Tathagatagarbha of Buddha nature. And so having come to have this understanding of suchness, and to be very alert to our capacity to cling, not just to our suffering, but also to spiritual progress. He says, knowing that the essential nature of reality is free from covetousness, we, in accord with that nature of reality, devote ourselves to the perfection of charity or giving. And so the author goes through now the paramitas. And so because practice brings us into confidence, it helps us to develop more and more confidence, more resilience, more equanimity, more clear seeing. The student, the bodhisattva, can become seduced by those very things. I've told the story before about how many years ago, you know, the nature of a sangha is people come in, they enter into training, some, and then they develop themselves, and some will stay throughout their lives, and some will go, right? It's always been this way. And I remember talking to Dada Roshi once when a fairly senior student had just left training. And we were talking about that, and I was just thinking of it sort of largely, and I thought, and I said to him, I said, well, you know, what seems to happen in training is that we build more and more confidence in ourselves. And he said, right. And more confidence in our understanding of the Dharma. He said, right. And more confidence in our ability to guide ourselves. And I said, right. And I said, why doesn't everybody leave early? Right? Why doesn't everybody get to the point where they think, oh, okay, I've got this? And he said, well, that's part of the role of the teacher and life, is to keep showing us, presenting us with the ways in which we're not yet finished, to put it that way. That there's more work to be done. Of course, we have to be open to that. We have to want to be seeing that. And so we have to be aware and alert to our capacity to fall within, to still be subject to those things that we have been practicing since the beginning and go through transformation, but still arise, may still arise, sometimes in the old ways, sometimes in more subtle ways. And so we practice the paramitas, the perfections of the bodhisattva, to help us to do that. And so realizing that generosity is the basic nature of reality, we devote ourselves to the practice of giving. The essential nature of reality is generous. Think about that. The universe itself, the sun, you know, we don't wake up and the sky is clear but the sun is dim one day and it's just like, I'm just not in the mood. I'm just feeling a little stingy today, sorry. Maybe I'll feel a little more generous tomorrow. Doesn't happen. And that's our nature. That same generosity, that same basically boundless giving. And yet, something so present, so basic into our nature can become dampened and confined and contracted. And so we practice giving. I mean, can we appreciate how powerful practice is? Why? Because you can practice it. It says it right there. Right? It's not hiding anything. And so what about when you're not feeling generous? Okay, that's cool. I understand that. I know that. That is not unusual. That is not foreign. Now, practice it. You know, our grasping, the things we seek, the things we hold on to, they all turn us in. They turn us in and kind of create a more protective, a more defended state. So that's a good practice, is to notice in a moment where you feel sort of held back. Not so giving. Not so generous. And just turn towards that. Experience that. How is that in that moment, in that state? What's the state of your union right then? And you'll see. Right? To the ability that you can see and to the depth of that holding back, you'll see how it feels. What it is to inhabit a state like that. And that's showing us something. Right? Why, when we withdraw, isn't it just withdrawal and everything else just stays exactly the same? It doesn't affect us in that way. That's showing us something about our nature. And in the same way that when we open that hand, even sometimes when we have to make it very deliberate, because sometimes we should, right? It's a good thing to do. It's actually what we want to do. And so we can say that to ourselves, I should do this, right? It would be good for me to do this. And then experience that. The Buddha once said, if everyone could understand the nature of giving, the nature of the self as I do, then no one would ever take a bite without feeding someone else first. I remember the first time I came across that, I felt so humbled and so drawn. And so there is giving gifts, material things, as I've often said, because that's a language everybody understands, and it's in a sense simple. There's the giving of saving life, protecting beings from fear, right? Which is a very profound thing. And then there's giving the gift of Dharma through your body, through your actions, through our words. And so in that we see that there's just endless opportunities to practice giving, endless. Right? We don't have to be in a particular situation or of a particular, you know, wealth or always to want to protect beings from fear, to want to be in the world in such a way that I don't cause you fear. I don't make you afraid of me. An old master said, to not engage in conceptual proliferation is freely giving. Think of it that way. To not be in conceptual proliferation, to be constantly proliferating thoughts, concepts, ideas, daydreaming, fantasies. To free ourselves of that is itself giving. To not appropriate, to not possess, to not manipulate. And then there's transcendent morality, the precepts, discipline. Transcendent here is prajna. So it's giving that is based in selflessness, based in unity rather than dividing. It's morality, moving within the world of things and situations and right and wrong without dividing things into right and wrong. Knowing the essential nature of reality, that it is free from attachment to the desires of the five senses, the bodhisattva, in accord with this, devotes themselves to the perfection of the precepts. You know, attachments don't exist on their own. And that may or may not seem self-evident, but it's actually very profound. They don't just exist, right? They have to be brought into being. And so the precepts are saying that within a state of attachment, of grasping, of fear, of self-clinging, right, of dividing, of othering, there will be killing. There will be stealing. There will be lying. There will be using the miracle of sexuality to injure. There will be clouding the mind, speaking of others' errors and faults, elevating the self and blame. There will be anger. Right? There will be stinginess. There will be defilement, trying to destroy that which is sacred. These things are virtually inevitable, right? Because they make sense from within that divided mind. Seeing the world that way, how could we not but act out of that division? And so to live in non-harming, right? Just that, to live in non-harming, to want our lives to be of benefit. The old master said, to not get involved in discursive thought is illuminated morality. Morality that illuminates self and other, that illuminates situations, that illuminates action and consequence. It helps us to see. Right? That's such a powerful way of, you know, when you're in a situation where you really want to go in this direction and you know it's not the right path, but you really want to go in that direction, right? And the desire wants to keep your mind very, very narrow, very focused on just get that thing. Get it. But studying karma means you recognize that and then you look ahead. Because you've been here before. You look ahead and you see, this leads to that. Do I want that too? Because it's a package deal. And the package is even bigger than that. They just keep arriving. Right? No, I only ordered one. No, that's not the deal. You weren't paying attention. And so think of the great challenge of this. The mind's deep, deep, old, well-worn habit of dividing. And so to stand in a place, in a time, in a situation, amongst people where there is massive dividing, massive hiddenness, massive concealment, massive not thinking this through, not reflecting on cause and effect, great desires, and standing on your own ground, knowing your mind. That's where the practitioner sometimes has to stand in aloneness, right? And be willing to go the way of the Buddha, which in that moment is your way, and to know what that is. And so there is then the transcendent patience, the patience of that. Knowing the essential nature of reality is without suffering, is free from anger and anxiety. Being in accord with this means we devote ourselves to the practice of the perfection of patience or forbearance. And it's very interesting. I used to really puzzle on the use of that word forbearance because, you know, to forbear means to hold a certain amount of pain, to hold something. You know, it's almost like enduring. It has some quality of that. And I thought, but no, we should never have to endure anything. But sometimes you do. You know, we have to forbear something that is very difficult. And it's challenging us, and we are at, and in a sense, we are being brought to our limits. And we practice that. And we practice it as best we can, which means it will be, to some degree, imperfect. And so there will be some pain. And to be able to hold that, forbear that, as we continue. Anger, fear, hatred, these too do not just exist. We have to bring them into being. And our internal conditions and our external conditions. And so is it any wonder that what is happening now in our country and the world is happening now in our country and the world, particularly in our country? That the seeds of this, of the anger and the protests and the state response and the killing and the tear gassing, while certainly not beginning 3 years ago, has been actively seeded in both subtle and very, very not subtle, explicit ways. How could this not be happening? In some form. I've often thought, how could, in a certain sense, how could we be surprised by anything that has happened in the last 3 years? Having seen what we saw about our present in everything leading up to that time. It was all on display. All there. And so patience, which patience within a crisis is a very challenging practice. Because how easy it is to get swept away, swept up. How difficult it can be to be in this, in community, whatever that community might be, even if it's a community of strangers, and to be in your own mind, to know your place and position there, to know your giving. You know, I just saw a little bit before Seishin about in Portland where there have been these protests and these walls of moms, you know, these mothers who lined up to face this wall of police. And the history of that, one of the papers was talking about the history of that in countries around the world where women over centuries have risen up and faced the state, whatever the state was. But the thing that got me so much was that within one of those protests and this wall of moms, a woman took off all of her clothes and sat down facing this wall of armored police where you couldn't see a single patch of skin from head to toe. Everything was covered. Mask, helmet, shield, everything was covered. And behind all of this shield, and this woman was sitting on the ground completely naked, facing them with her legs up and spread. And the photograph was from behind. And I thought, here we have self-power, true power, spiritual power, the power that can only come from within. That is the greatest force. And then we have the power invested by a role, by a state, by weapons. And I thought of that call, and I thought this woman was just sitting there saying, "You all came from here. Let us remember this. You all came from here. What are we doing?" I thought, she's a Dakini. She is a person of great power. You know, there was an article in the Times, I think, couple weeks ago, a little video article about a reporter who did some research on how police are trained in other parts of the country. Because one of the things I've been thinking about is, you know, with the calls for defunding and all of this, and of course, I'm just a monk. I don't know a lot about these things. But, you know, I keep thinking about, you know, why is all of this happening? Why are all of these shootings happening? And of course, white supremacy and our racial catastrophe that is 400 years and continuing, of course, is at the core of it. But also, how are we training people when something happens over and over and over? If something happens here, and this is not a fair comparison, but if something happens here that isn't working, if something happens anywhere and it's not working, a concerned person would say, what's not working here? How are we not training? How are we not preparing ourselves better? Unless that not working is what's the aim. But so this reporter went to Europe and did this report on Germany and Sweden of how police are trained. And one of the extraordinary things was they were talking to a trainer who said, when somebody is arrested, from the moment we have our hands on that person, they are now our responsibility, their well-being. It's our primary responsibility. We must care for that person. Such simple words. And they talked about how in the training that they did this massive amount of training to train the officers in how not to shoot. Most of the training went into doing everything they could to not shoot. In other words, to de-escalate. De-escalate. Right? We know something about that. Right? We know how to de-escalate when something is arising. Right? In a much less lethal situation, admittedly. But just the intention, what do we want these people who carry lethal force and our protectors to be trained to be that? And so there's this massive training on de-escalation. And at the very end, there's like, oh yeah, this is how you shoot the gun. And they talked about in the U.S., it's like completely opposite. That they said something like, might receive an hour and a half or so on de-escalation, like, which means nothing. Could that be? Could that really be? And so that image of that woman sitting completely naked, completely vulnerable, and so powerful in her vulnerability, knowing the ground that she stands on. It reminded me of a story years ago. I was in the prison doing a Zazen Kai, and one of the students who came in, and he said, you know, I've been in prisons all over the state. He said, I've been in some really, really bad places where violence was epidemic. It happened all the time. He said, you just get used to it. You kind of don't see it. And he said, the other day I was in the yard and there was some commotion and suddenly a guy went down and he'd been stabbed. And everybody backed away and the sirens were blaring and all the guards were coming in. He said, I'd seen this 100,000 times before. He said, and I just felt overwhelmed with the sadness of it. And he said, I realize we're all caught in this thing, all of us. Those of us who are incarcerated are caught in it. The guards are caught in it. We're all caught in this thing. And the other way of looking at it is all being caught in it. We have to all untangle ourselves together. And so that dividing mind As Buddhists, we understand this is the heart of the matter. That's why the Buddha said the whole human world is a moral world. The whole human world is a world of compassion and dukkha. That's our nature. That's the world we live in. The only way to be in this world is that way. And so there is transcendent diligence and effort, joyful vigor, zeal, as Gokhan talked about, knowing that the essential nature of reality is free from indolence. Bodhisattvas, in accord with this, devote themselves to the perfection of effort, joyful effort, which again, like all of these practices, all these virtues, is really bringing ourselves into alignment, into harmony with the rest of the world, right? The rest of the universe is like on this already. The rest of the world is alive. Aliveness is everything, everywhere. And to bring that into our practice, that enthusiasm, right? It's not a mechanical aliveness, it's joyful aliveness. I remember years ago, Jisho, who was she was the chief disciple, and she was sitting in this seat because that's where Shuso used to sit. Well, that seat, actually. And we were getting ready for Zazen. It was during Sesshin. I think it was the mid-morning period. And I was sitting, somewhere. And there was a bunch of people that were students who were lined up in the back while the han was sounding, just sort of waiting to come in. And she's sitting here and she looks up and she says, "What are you waiting for? Get to your seat." What are we waiting for? We shouldn't wait for the last minute. And so aligning ourselves, bringing this forward, this enthusiastic way of being, and bringing that into practice. I mean, when we talk about wholeheartedness, the whole body and mind, it is that. You know, laziness is like this illusion that, you know, this is going to last forever, right? So I can, like, you know, and this has nothing to do with resting. It has nothing to do with enjoying life. It's a state of mind. It's a state of dullness. It's a state of not caring. It's like a state that, like, life is wastable. You know, I can throw this away. To not think of abandonment of cultivation is effort. And so to be diligent in our practice, and for most of us, that also means don't work so hard. Right? Most people who are drawn to Buddhist practice know how to work hard. And we've learned some really good things in this, and I definitely count myself among them. But we've also learned things that aren't particularly helpful, and we bring them right into practice. And they wear us down. And so to be very diligent and not work so hard, what is that? Transcendent concentration. Nature of reality is calm and free from confusion. That's its essence. And so be in alignment with that by practicing prajna zazen, the meditation infused with wisdom. Let your mind, which is inherently unified, be unified, not divide. When discriminating thoughts arise, don't divide them. Don't divide yourself from them. Which leads us to transcendent wisdom itself, prajnaparamita, which is the third aspiration for enlightenment through insight. And that faith mind says, realizing suchness, we speak of suchness or enlightenment as an object because of the evolving mind, because we need to speak and express. But in fact, there is no object. There is no thing. There is nothing that suchness can point to. There is no thing in which we can find what we call enlightenment. There is only the direct experience into suchness. This transcends both the seer and the seen, the practitioner and the realization. And we call this the body of the Buddha, your reality body. Another master spoke of this, that when we meet this wisdom, this prajna, when we meet yourself, when you meet yourself, it's like a parent meeting the child. Meeting somebody that you recognize already. Maybe that's what's in those first glimmers when we encounter the Dharma and there's that sense of faith or trust or confidence. This is true. How can I know that? I don't know, but it's true. Maybe it's because in some way we're already touching, having a meeting with that parent, with our parent, that we know already. We can't quite make out their face. But there's a sense that I've seen you before. I have been here before. This is not something strange and foreign. No master said, there's recognition and realization on this very ground. And at that time, wisdom, prajna, practice, skillfulness, all become one, all become unified. It's like, as that becomes more and more clear, it's like, now we understand. We understand why we practice. We understand why we get caught. We understand our delusion. We understand the division. It makes so much sense. We understand the anger, the self-righteous anger that arises. It makes so much sense from that place. This merging brings the experience of union, of non-duality, which is like rivers from different mountains all flowing into one ocean. The rivers may come from different mountains, but they merge, they dissolve, they become indistinguishable. You can't tell them apart anymore because they are one basic element that are finally meeting. In the same way, your mind, your Buddha mind, and your ordinary everyday mind, the mind of your clinging and the mind of your letting go, are the same. That in that moment of that woman, that courageous bodhisattva facing in her nakedness this wall of armor, in that moment something profound is happening. How many see that? How many could see that in that moment? When I first glanced, I thought, oh my God, it's all here. It's all here. If we could see it. How can we be in this moment and this division still be real? How can something so stark, so unforgettable, so piercing be piercing through everything and everyone? And we carry on as before. And yet, all of these many rivers from all of these many mountains merging. We bow in deep respect to Prajnaparamita, mother of all Buddhas, wisdom beyond wisdom, knowing beyond knowing. She illuminates all of our delusions and dispels our fears. She is you. This great mother resides within you and us and everyone, the hater and the hated, the vilified and the vilifier, the tyrant and the oppressed. You know, that's why Sean was mentioning John Lewis's passing, and I really been reflecting a lot because he was such an extraordinary being. Going into the dragon's cave over and over and over, and to think about the incredible discipline of all of those in all of those protests and marches and sit-ins who discipline and train themselves in non-harming so that when they were in the midst of violence, they could stay in their own ground, know who they were, know what their aspiration was, and stay true to that. They are in our legacy, too. They are our ancestors, too. This great mother.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.